We would welcome everybody here to the 10 o'clock session. Just remind everyone, please turn your cell phones to silence. We also are supposed to remind everybody that there is a book sales room and encourage everybody to go and support that. I'm excited to hear this topic, and when Mary Ellen offered to let me chair a session, I volunteered Josh for this. This is a topic that's intrigued me for some time. Josh has a BA degree from Brigham Young University and a double major in philosophy and classical studies with a Greek emphasis. Also has minors in logic and psychology, and is now currently a PhD student in philosophy at Princeton University. Very impressive. His primary areas of research are aesthetics, areas of ethics such as psychology and meta-ethics. I don't even know what that is. See how impressed I am? And Greco-Roman philosophy, 6th and 5th centuries in the Hellenistic period. He has taught classes in Nietzsche, logic, ethics, and has presented papers at Oxford and Princeton. I think we're going to be highly instructed here with the things that he has to say. The respondent is somebody who's probably known to most of us. Maxine Hanks has been writing on feminist issues and edited and contributed to Women in Authority, a book that's probably most of us have read or at least are familiar with. She's a feminist theologian, a Gnostic clergy, a scholar of women's studies, particularly in religion. She's been a fellow at the Harvard Divinity School and has co-authored or authored 5 books, including Women in Authority. So you have like 35 minutes, and we'll try to be a little, according to this, so if it goes too much longer, I'll just let you know that we're... Okay.
Is it going to be okay with everyone if I just stand down here and sort of shout?
Get that mic there so that you record it.
Does this work?
Yeah. Okay. Slow down.
Can everybody hear me? All right. So I'm Josh Dillon. And this is my paper, Mormon Women Had Priesthood in 1843. In Mormon Women Had the Priesthood since 1843, D. Micah Quinn argues for the conclusion that his title states. His case is fivefold. He argues first that prior to the institution of the endowment, Joseph Smith taught publicly and wrote privately that LDS women were to receive priesthood. Second, that by virtue of their participation in the Holy Order or anointed quorum, some LDS women in Nauvoo understood themselves to be, and were understood by other Latter-day Saints to be, recipients of priesthood. Third, that from the 1840s until well into the 20th century, LDS church patriarchs and other prominent church members and leaders spoke of some women as being priesthood holders. Fourth, that LDS women have performed and continue to perform priesthood ordinances. And fifth, that claims that LDS women do not have priesthood can all be traced to some combination of historical ignorance, misunderstanding of Mormon theology, inattention to current Mormon practice, or misogyny. While the evidence that Quinn marshals is impressive, there is ample reason to question his conclusion. In this paper, I wish to argue that Quinn is correct in one sense, but mistaken in another. I wish to grant, as Quinn's argument seemed to me to demand, that Mormon women had priesthood in 1843, in one important sense of the word priesthood. Moreover, Mormon women still have priesthood in that sense of the word, and consequently have had priesthood since 1843, in the relevant sense of priesthood. If the relevant notion of priesthood were the one current in contemporary Mormonism, Quinn's conclusions would be correct. However, I wish to argue that no consistent notion of priesthood persists through Mormon history, and that the contemporary LDS notion of priesthood is actually incoherent. As a result, the question whether Mormon women have, or ever have had, priesthood in the contemporary sense of the word is not even well formed. No sense can be made of what it means, and no answer can be given to it. So while LDS women did and do have priesthood in one important sense of priesthood, LDS women cannot be rightly said to hold priesthood in the contemporary sense of the word. Neither, for that matter, can LDS men. So, okay. Within Mormonism, priesthood is often defined in terms of power and authority. True to the Faith says that priesthood is the eternal power and authority of God. Slightly less ambitiously, the Guide to the Scriptures, which is published in all of the foreign language editions of the Standard Works and is also available on LDS.org, states that the authority and power, that priesthood is the authority and power that God gives to man to act in all things for the salvation of men. Bruce R. McConkie splits the difference in Mormon doctrine and claims that as pertaining to eternity, priesthood is the eternal power and authority of deity, whereas, as pertaining to man's existence on this earth, priesthood is the power and authority of God delegated to man on earth to act in all things for the salvation of men. And the recent General Conference address defines priesthood as the authority to act in the name of God. While none of these definitions is identical to any of the others, there's a strong family resemblance between them. All of them define priesthood in terms of divine power or authority. Now, in standard English, that's not what the word priesthood means. It just isn't. You can look it up in the OED, and here's what you will find. Priesthood is the office or function of being a priest. That's it. And if you look up the word priest, it tells you that the relevant definition is any person whose office is to perform a public religious function. So priesthood is the office or duty of performing a religious function or religious functions. Now, I made one slight emendation here. You'll notice that the word priest is defined in terms of public religious functions. I think it's safe to say that in a Mormon context, we can drop the word public, since so many of our religious functions aren't even viewable by the public, at least not officially so. And so in the context of Mormonism, if priesthood has anything like a standard meaning, that's what it should be. Priesthood is the office or duty of performing a religious function or religious functions. And so when we get around to asking whether Mormon women have priesthood, this just boils down to two sub-questions. The first question that we should be asking is, what are the essential or most characteristic religious functions that it might be the office or duty of a Mormon to perform? And the second question is it ever the office or duty of Mormon women to perform those functions? Okay. Now, Quinn claims that the answer to the second of those questions is yes. Certainly, recognized priesthood holders, such as deacons, priests, bishops, perform many functions, such as blessing and passing the sacrament, baptizing new converts, collecting offerings, and presiding over certain meetings, that Mormon women are not authorized by the church to perform. However, Quinn claims that such functions are not characteristic of or essential to Mormon priesthood. According to Quinn, the essential functions and capacity of LDS priesthood holders are embodied in the temple endowment. And consequently, he thinks that every endowed Mormon woman has received priesthood from 1843, the year that Emma Smith received the endowment, down to the present. Administrative tasks, such as presiding over meetings or performing certain rituals and ordinances, may be assigned to only a subset of LDS priesthood holders. But such tasks, he claims, are merely appendages to a more central class of functions that all endowed Mormons, including women, are authorized to perform. As Quinn puts the point, a woman does not need an appendage to have priesthood. Now, do Mormon women have priesthood? Here's Quinn's answer, yes. Here's why, this is Quinn's answer. The most essential or characteristic religious functions that it might be the office or duty of a Mormon to perform are those that people are under covenant to perform by virtue of being endowed. Lots of Mormon women are endowed. And so we can cast Quinn's argument in purely logical terms like this. I'm a philosopher by training, not a historian. This is the sort of shit that I care about, okay? Logically, this is the way the argument ought to go. Priesthood is the office or duty of performing religious functions. That's just a definition. The essential functions of Mormon priesthood are contained in the endowment. That is a substantive theological claim that Quinn makes. Many Mormon women have been endowed. I take it that none of us question that. And now it just follows logically that many Mormon women have the duty of performing the essential functions of Mormon priesthood. And given the definition of priesthood, that just means that many Mormon women are priesthood holders. If you accept statements 1, 2, and 3, you have to accept statement 5, as a matter of pure logic. 1 is a definition, 3 is completely uncontroversial, and so the entire bulk of Quinn's argument rests on statement 2. Now, when you get clear on that, it becomes apparent that Quinn's point is theological, not historical. And that's why the historical evidence that he cites, as impressive as it is not sufficient to make his point. Unless Mormon theology has remained basically unchanged for the past century and a half, mid-19th century statements about Mormon theology aren't a reliable guide to whether Mormon women have priesthood today. In order to demonstrate that LDS women have had priesthood since 1843, Quinn needs to argue not just that they had priesthood in 1843, but that the Mormon theology of priesthood has remained basically unchanged ever since. This is the argument Quinn actually gives. You start with the same definition of priesthood, and then he gives a lot of documentary evidence that according to 19th century Mormon theology, the essential functions of priesthood were contained in the endowment, and that lots of 19th century Mormon women were endowed. Now, the only conclusion that follows from that is that lots of 19th century Mormon women had priesthood. And in order to get from that conclusion, the conclusion that Quinn is entitled to the conclusion he actually wants, you need to add another premise to the argument. And here's the premise you have to add. Both the Mormon theology of priesthood and the practice of endowing women have remained basically unchanged since the 19th century. Here's the problem. Quinn completely neglects that point, and in fact, the evidence he cites tends to support rather the opposite conclusion. This is what he says. That beginning at the end of the 19th century, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve redefined many LDS doctrines. The relation of women to the priesthood endowment was only one of these redefinitions. So for all Quinn says, Mormon women may have had and may still have priesthood according to the theology of 19th century Mormonism, without having priesthood according to contemporary LDS theology. Now, I've been a little bit hasty here. The real plausibility of Quinn's view lies in its connection to contemporary Mormonism. In the current temple ceremony, Mormon women are referred to priestesses, even though they're never explicitly ordained to a priesthood office. And in current temple worship, Mormon women perform ordinances that men can't perform without being ordained. And so there's reason to think that even though Quinn's arguments aren't necessarily decisive in supporting his view, his conclusions are nevertheless broadly correct. Here's the crucial question that we have to answer in order to determine whether that's in fact the case. According to contemporary Mormon theology, are the essential functions of priesthood still contained in the endowment? I think the answer is no. But in order to establish that, we're going to have to look a little bit more carefully at the way that Mormons use the word priesthood today. One peculiar feature of the contemporary LDS notion of priesthood is that it is supposed to be eternal and unchanging. On Sundays, Mormons sing hymns such as See the Mighty Priesthood Gathered and O Thou Before the World Began about the changeless nature of the priesthood. The current priesthood manual, Gospel Principles, explicitly states that priesthood, as it exists in the church today, has always been associated with God's work. And even more tellingly, Mormons appeal to priesthood lines of authority to stake a claim to the singularity of Mormon priesthood. Now, lines of authority just absolutely militate against the idea that the contemporary notion of priesthood allows any room at all for the idea that priesthood ever changes. And here's why. Every ordained member of the church claims to have received priesthood from someone else who received priesthood from someone else who received priesthood from someone who received it from Joseph Smith, who received it from Peter, James, and John, who received it from Jesus. And so what lines of authority are supposed to do is they're supposed to act as pedigrees that validate Mormon claims to priesthood by proving that we have exactly the same priesthood today that Joseph Smith had. If the word priesthood doesn't mean the same thing today that it meant in the 1840s, lines of authority are useless. All they prove is that we have priesthood in the sense that Joseph Smith meant it. And so if we don't mean the same thing today, lines of authority do absolutely nothing to show that Mormons have priesthood in the sense of the word that they claim to have it. So Mormons really need to think that priesthood is the same thing today that it was in the writings of Joseph Smith, and particularly in the Doctrine and Covenants. LDS hymns, manuals, and lines of authority all say so. Also, if the word priesthood doesn't mean the same thing that it meant in the DNC, then Mormons completely fail to engage with their own liturgy, either that or systematically misinterpret it, every time they talk about priesthood when they refer to the Doctrine and Covenants. And so we should take it as a working hypothesis, at the very least, that the contemporary Mormon notion of priesthood is broadly consistent with what we see in the DNC. There are five very good reasons to think that the notion of priesthood in the DNC is just exactly the notion that I started this presentation with. The only meaning of the word priesthood that is common, according to the OED, from Old English through the 19th century and up to today, is that priesthood is the function of performing a religious function, or is the office of performing a religious function. There just isn't any other definition that Joseph Smith would have known. The DNC contains no other such definition. Now, ordinarily, when we're reading a text or listening to someone in conversation, we assume that they're using words in perfectly standard ways, unless they give us some reason to think they're not. That is, unless we can't make any sense of what they're saying without reinterpreting them, or unless they explicitly tell us that they're using the word in a non-standard way. Joseph Smith never does that. Another point is that technical vocabulary, non-standard usage of language, really only makes sense in the context of a well-established theology or set of doctrines. But the Mormon notion of priesthood just wasn't that well developed in the 1830s when most of the Doctrine and Covenants was being written. If you look at sections 13, 20, 121, 132, 107, what you notice is that there's steady development concerning the doctrines relating to priesthood throughout the period of Dancy's composition. And so there just wasn't a technical vocabulary in which the word priesthood could have had a specialized theological meaning. Moreover, the Doctrine and Covenants isn't even a unified composition. It's a whole bunch of different writings and sermons that were all compiled at a later date, largely not by Joseph Smith. And so it would just be bizarre if there were a consistent technical vocabulary with it. And the most important point is that the text of the Doctrine and Covenants makes best sense on the assumption that the word priesthood within it just refers to the office of performing a religious function, whatever that function happens to be. Here's a proof text. DNC section 68, 1 through 3. My servant was called by his ordination to proclaim the everlasting gospel by the Spirit of the living God from people to people and from land to land in the congregations of the wicked in their synagogues, reasoning with and expounding all scriptures unto them. And behold, and lo, this is an ensample unto all those who were ordained unto this priesthood, whose mission is appointed unto them to go forth. Now, we have a reference in verse 2 here to this priesthood. It just raises the question, what is the grammatical antecedent of the demonstrative pronoun? This. There's a clear grammatical antecedent. To proclaim the everlasting gospel by the Spirit of the living God, etc., etc. That is what this priesthood is. It is to proclaim the gospel, etc., etc. If you don't believe me, just look at the word ordination. The ordination to proclaim this everlasting gospel is referred to in the subsequent verse as the ordination to this priesthood. Now, the first thing to notice is that there is the word this in front of priesthood. That implies that there are many other priesthoods, of which this is just one. And the second thing to notice is that the priesthood in question is just a particular religious function, proclaiming the gospel. Next case, DNC section 112. Purify your hearts before me, and then go ye into all the world and preach my gospel unto every creature who has not received it. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, and he that believeth not and is not baptized shall be damned, for unto you is the power of this priesthood given. Again, we have a mention of this priesthood, which again implies that it's just one priesthood among others. Again, there is a clear grammatical antecedent of the demonstrative pronoun, namely, to go into all the world and preach my gospel unto every creature who has not received it. And again, this is just a particular religious function. Now, this passage is even better than that, because in verse 30 there, it mentions the power of priesthood. Notice that means that the word priesthood can't mean power. It can't mean anything like power. Otherwise, that last verse would say, unto you is given the power of this power, which doesn't even make sense. Priesthood does not mean power in the Doctrine and Covenants. It just means the office of performing a religious function. The power in question, by the way, is actually specified in the verse in the middle, namely, he that believeth and is baptized will be saved, and he that believeth not and is not baptized shall be damned. And so the way that the theology of priesthood works here, priesthood is just the office of performing a particular religious function, and when God gives you a function, he gives you powers that correspond to the performance of it. There isn't anything else to priesthood in the Doctrine and Covenants. There's just not. Now, I suspect that there's been confusion on this point in the past, because two particular priesthoods within the text of the D&C are given special attention. I have in mind the Melchizedek priesthood and the Aaronic priesthood. People read this and they get the idea that those are the only two kinds of priesthood, and that you can't understand the notion of priesthood in general without thinking of it in terms of Aaronic priesthoods and Melchizedek priesthoods. But if you just look at the text, it becomes perfectly obvious that that is not true. D&C section 107.5. Speaking of the Melchizedek priesthood, says that all other authorities or offices in the church are appendages to this priesthood. I want you to pay special attention to the words other and this. The fact that we call it this priesthood implies that there are others. The fact that we talk about other offices being an appendage to it presupposes that the Melchizedek priesthood itself just is a particular office in the church. Now, the text goes on to specify which office it is. It is the office of providing for the spiritual needs of the members. And the reason why all other offices are appendages to it is just that every office in the church is concerned in one way or another with providing for the spiritual needs of the membership. No special meaning of the word priesthood here. And so, it is no mere accident, nor is it a result of lexical ambiguity, that Emma Smith is spoken of in section 25 as having been ordained to an office when she is assigned the official religious function of organizing the hymn book. She has been given a priesthood in the 1830s sense of the word. And, like all other religious tasks that one might have the duty to perform, hers deals with the spiritual well-being of the members of the church, and therefore falls under the broader heading of the Melchizedek priesthood. Her priesthood differs from other priesthoods just to the extent that the function it is her office to perform, namely organizing a hymn book, differs from the functions, such as blessing and passing the sacrament, that it may be the duty of someone with a different priesthood to perform. That's the entire idea of priesthood in the Doctrine and Covenants. I'm convinced there just isn't any more to it. Now, before I go any further, it's worthwhile to point out what this means in terms of where I agree and disagree with D. Michael Quinn's paper. On one crucial point, Quinn and I are in perfect agreement. Many Mormon women had priesthood in the early days of the church. On another crucial point, Quinn and I disagree. According to Quinn, Mormon women received priesthood by being endowed in the temple. But what I've argued is that priesthood in the text of the D&C is simply the office or duty of performing any old religious function, and consequently, any woman who has been given such an office or duty is, in the relevant sense, a priesthood holder. This, and not the quickly approaching institution of temple worship, is enough to explain why Joseph Smith spoke of women receiving priesthood when the Relief Society was organized. Every office within the Relief Society, including mere membership in it, comes with the official duty of performing certain religious functions specified in the Relief Society Declaration. And so membership in the Relief Society is a priesthood in the relevant sense of the word, and members of the Relief Society are, in the relevant sense, priesthood holders. So, pretty much every Mormon woman holds priesthood in the sense of priesthood that is common in the Doctrine and Covenants. That being said, I think that Quinn is right in claiming that there is an important connection between priesthood and the temple endowment. I just think he's wrong about what it is. On my view, endowed members of the church hold priesthood of a particular kind. It is their duty or office to perform those functions that the endowment places them under covenant to perform. And so it makes perfect sense that members of the church are referred to in the endowment as...
What the hell?
It makes perfect sense why members of the church are referred to as priests and priestesses in the endowment. They just undertook a bunch of covenants to perform official religious duties, and that's being a priesthood holder. Now, I should make one other really unfortunate point before I continue. If I'm right about what priesthood is in the Doctrine and Covenants, then the fact that women were recognized as priesthood holders is not by itself evidence that there was a greater degree of gender equality in the early church than there is today. After all, it may be the case that in the early church, men and women were alike in receiving priesthoods, but differed in the priesthoods that they were given. The fact that women were given official religious duties does not by itself provide any evidence that they were given the same religious duties as men. Which just underscores the point that even if we start admitting that women have the priesthood, that's not going to cure misogyny in the church. You can give women priesthood, you can admit that they have religious functions that matter, and you can still discriminate on the basis of gender who performs which functions. And so, while I wish I could say that the early church were egalitarian, talk about priesthood isn't evidence of that. Now, in contemporary Mormonism, the misogyny that I'm referring to has been manifest in, among other ways, a complete change in meaning of the word priesthood. While many Mormon women, Relief Society leaders, young women's leaders, visiting teachers, sister missionaries, primary leaders and teachers, female temple ordinance workers, are still generally recognized as holding church offices, they are not invited to ward stake or general priesthood meetings. If the word priesthood still meant the office of performing a religious function, it would amount to a perplexing misuse of language to refer to a meeting as a priesthood meeting when so many of the officers of the church aren't invited. Additionally, gospel principles, the current priesthood manual states specifically that males, but not females, hold priesthood in the church, a point which is reinforced in lesson 13 of the church's very regrettably titled The Latter-day Saint Woman, a Basic Manual for Women, Part A. Furthermore, if priesthood were simply the office of performing religious functions, we would expect Mormons to refer to Catholic priests, who quite obviously perform official religious functions for their parishioners, as priesthood holders. Mormons don't refer to women officers as priesthood holders. Mormons do not refer to Catholic priests as priesthood holders. That's just proof that the word doesn't mean the same thing anymore. Now, the point about Catholic priests is admittedly a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I take it for granted that when Mormons talk about priesthood, they're talking about Mormon priesthood, not about Catholic priesthood. And so maybe we wouldn't refer to Catholic priests as priesthood holders, even if the priesthood still meant the same thing. But that just underscores the point about women. Mormon women hold offices in the Mormon church. The only explanation for why we don't ordinarily consider them priesthood holders is that the word doesn't mean that they used to. So, the way that Mormons use this word is just perplexing to me. And unfortunately, all of the definitions that we give ourselves of priesthood are so transparently stupid that they're of no help at all in figuring out what the hell it is that we're supposed to be talking about. Here's the first stupid definition. Priesthood is the power of God. Now, this is the definition you find in Truth of Faith. It's the definition you find in chapter 13 of Gospel Principles. It's the definition that's familiar from discourses by Brigham Young and John Taylor. And it's not only wrong, no one in the church even believes it. I've had the priesthood since I was 12. I've never created efficiency or a creeping thing of the earth. I do not and never have had the power of God. And if I stood up and tried to claim over the pulpit in sacrament meeting that I have the literal power of God, I would be accused of heresy or blasphemy or worse. That definition does not make any sense at all of the way that Mormons actually use the word priesthood. Now, you can fix it by defining priesthood as the authority to act in the name of deity. This is the definition that's familiar from chapter 14 of Gospel Principles. It's a definition that Henry B. Eyring used in a 2009 conference address. I take it it's fairly common. Now, you've got to be really careful with this definition not to pin down too closely which God you have in mind. The sacrament is blessed in the name of Jesus. People are baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And so if this definition is to have any credibility at all, priesthood has to be to act in the name of deity very broadly construed. And once you realize that, the problem just becomes obvious. Every member of the church, including six-year-old boys and girls, are authorized to pray to God in the name of Jesus. They are, that is to say, authorized to act in the name of God, but no one in the church thinks that they hold priesthood. So this definition is just wrong. It doesn't square with what we actually do. Now you can fix that by doing what the Encyclopedia of Mormonism does. You say priesthood is the authority to perform ordinances in the name of deity, broadly construed. Since prayer isn't ordinarily thought of as an ordinance, the fact that people can pray in the name of deity isn't a problem for this definition. This definition is, however, inconsistent with church practice on two other counts. The first thing is that most priesthood holders can't perform a lot of ordinances in the church. And the second problem is that there are some ordinances in the church, washing and anointings come to mind, that people who are not ordinarily recognized as priesthood holders, female temple workers, can perform. And so, not only does this definition not square with the people we recognize as priesthood holders, it also doesn't square with a lot of the people who we don't recognize as priesthood holders. Now, I suspect that it's out of awareness of problems like this that priesthood is sometimes defined in a completely different way. Brigham Young and John Taylor started doing this back in, the 1840s, defining priesthood in terms of church government. Priesthood, they said, is the divine system and government of God. It is the only system of government that can deliver mankind from all of the evils that currently face it. This definition doesn't work either. For one thing, to have the priesthood is not to have a government. Every member of the church, whether they have the priesthood or not, has the same church government. And so the priesthood is not the government. Everyone has one, not everyone has the other. More to the point, if priesthood were just the divine system of government, then everyone else within that government would be recognized as a priesthood holder, which just isn't the case. Female officers of the church are not widely regarded as priesthood holders. And so that definition also does not square with current Mormon practice. Now, strictly speaking, I've got to admit that I can't completely rule out the possibility that someone could come up with some bizarre definition of priesthood that made sense of the way the Mormons actually talk. I doubt that that's possible. But, I mean, you could come up with any old definition you like. I haven't heard all of them, and maybe one of them sort of works. But even if you could come up with a definition that sort of made sense of contemporary church practice, it still wouldn't save the theological notion of priesthood in Mormonism. And here's why. According to the Doctrine and Covenants, everyone officially charged with performing a religious function holds priesthood. That is the notion of priesthood in the DNC. According to contemporary Mormonism, female officers of the church do not hold priesthood. But, according to contemporary Mormonism, priesthood today is the same as priesthood in the time of Joseph Smith. Those three statements, put them together however you like, they contradict each other. And what that means is that there is no coherent and consistent theology of priesthood in contemporary Mormonism. There just isn't one. On the upside, that means that there are no solid theological grounds whatever for denying that Mormon women do not or should not have priesthood. There's no consistent theology. You can't make theological arguments about it. On the downside, there can be no solid theological grounds for claiming that Mormon women do or should have priesthood. Now, this is my most central disagreement with D. Michael Quinn's paper. What he argues is that once you rightly understand the notion of priesthood, and for him that means understanding it in terms of the temple endowment, the thing you come to realize is that Mormon women have the priesthood and have had it since 1843 when the first Mormon woman was endowed. If what I've said is right, however, there just isn't a coherent notion of priesthood in Mormonism at all. You can't make sense of the question whether Mormon women have priesthood. And so the only right way of answering that question is to say, let's get rid of the idea of priesthood. Which I'm now going to argue is precisely what we should do. What I've argued so far is that the notion of priesthood in contemporary Mormonism is incoherent theologically. That does not mean that the word priesthood doesn't play an identifiable role in Mormon discourse. It plays a clearly identifiable role. That role just isn't theological. Now, here's something that you might think. You might think that the word priesthood is just an abstract noun, like mercy, love, or life experience. If you think that, you're wrong. Here's how you can tell. Mormons always talk about the priesthood. The Doctrine and Covenants doesn't do this, but contemporary Mormons, when they talk about priesthood, they never talk about priesthood, or a priesthood, or this priesthood. They always talk about the priesthood. Compare that to other abstract nouns, mercy, love, and life experience. People who want mercy, or want love, or want life experience, never say that they want the mercy, or the love, or the life experience. Grammatically, the word priesthood does not function like other abstract nouns. Now, there is an abstract noun in English that always occurs with a definite article. It is the Iron Curtain. So you might think that the word priesthood functions grammatically like the Iron Curtain, but you'd be mistaken about that too. Here's why. The Iron Curtain is not the sort of thing that anyone can have. No one has ever had the Iron Curtain. People have the priesthood all the time. The trick is to find a noun that pretty much always occurs with a definite article that someone can also have. That would be a pretty good clue to the linguistic function of the word priesthood in contemporary Mormonism. Since abstract nouns don't work, you might think that the best hope is to find a concrete noun. So let's look at some concrete nouns. Banjo, carburetor, sausage. These are words that can occur with definite articles. It makes perfectly good sense to talk about the carburetor in my old car. To that extent, these words look like they function sort of like priesthood. Also, you can have a carburetor, you can have a banjo, you can have a sausage. And so, in that respect, these words function like priesthood. However, none of these words characteristically occur with a definite article. I only talk about the carburetor or the banjo when I only have one carburetor or banjo in mind and there's absolutely no question which one it is. If there's a question about which banjo I'm referring to, I don't say the banjo. I tell you which banjo. And so, for that reason, you know, since most nouns can refer to a whole lot of different objects, there are a lot of banjos in the story, it's really rare to find a concrete noun that always occurs with a definite article. There are a few. The universe, the sun, the earth, these are words that always occur with a definite article. But again, these aren't the sorts of words that someone can be spoken of as having. You can't have the sun. You can bask in it. You can't have the earth. You can pollute it. And so these just aren't words that function linguistically the way that Priestley does. They always have a definite article, but they do not meet the criterion of being the sort of thing that someone can be spoken of as having. As far as I can tell, there is only one word in ordinary English that functions linguistically basically the same way that the word priesthood functions in contemporary Mormonism. That word is plague. I hesitated to use this example because it looks like I'm playing a cheap rhetorical game. This is actually the only word I could think of. The word plague pretty much always occurs with the word the in front of it. We talk about the plague. And the plague is something that you can have. You can have the plague, right? So in those two respects, the word plague functions linguistically like the word plague. The plague, however, is a really bizarre case. The word plague can, of course, refer to lots of things other than the bubonic plague. It can refer to the plague of locusts. And if I talk to you about the plague of locusts, there's no confusion about what I mean. I just have to tell you that that's the plague I have in mind. The reason we're able to refer to the bubonic plague as the plague rather than just a plague is that the bubonic plague has had way more importance culturally on our society. It was a really big deal, and because of that, it impacted our language, and now we talk about the plague rather than specifying that it's the bubonic plague we have in mind. And so linguistically, the word plague actually serves three distinct functions in our ordinary idiom. First of all, it's a regular noun that can refer to a wide range of diseases, misfortunes, or epidemics. In its most common usage, in the phrase the plague, it refers specifically to one plague among many others, the bubonic plague. And to the extent that it refers just to that one, instead of any of the others, it's a rhetorical marker of the historical importance of that disease compared to all of the other ones. The reason we call the bubonic plague is because it's more important. And so if priesthood works the same way that plague does grammatically, we should expect it to perform three roughly parallel functions. We should...
Judge, I'm sorry, you're worth 40 minutes. Can you round it up? Sorry.
Make your final argument.
Okay. Priesthood doesn't do this. Here's why. We don't use the word priesthood to refer to a wide range of offices in the church. We use the word priesthood to refer to one specific thing, offices held by men. The way that we do this, as I've already argued, is completely theologically incoherent. And so, unlike the word plague, the word priesthood doesn't refer to a wide range of things, and unlike the word plague, it doesn't refer to any specific thing at all. There is only one function left for the word priesthood to perform in Mormonism. Oops. There it is. The only function left for the word priesthood to serve is to be a rhetorical marker of a theologically unjustified 19th century prejudice according to which women's religious functions are less important than men. I think sexism is bad. Maybe that's controversial. I think it sucks. Since I don't think that sexism has any role to play in our religion, I don't think that cheap rhetorical devices used to mark and reinforce sexism have any role to play in our religion. And so while I'm perfectly willing to concede that lots of Mormon women had priesthood in 1843, I hope that one day none of us have the priesthood. Whatever the fuck that's even supposed to mean.
Paper. I'm excited when younger scholars engage the work of us older scholars, particularly on gender issues and priesthood, but also I appreciate the deep analytical work he's done on this piece and on the issue. Because when we were working on this essay, I worked with Mike on this essay, and we deeply considered all of us who were in the book, Women in Authority, and including Margaret Toscano and Paul and Janice and everyone who was in that book, we deeply considered these issues. And we sort of had a certain amount of space to try to squeeze some of our arguments into and get that book out by Christmas. So, you know, we were rushed and we would have loved to have taken the time to explore these more deeply, which Josh has done beautifully. And I agree with many of his premises and probably disagree with a couple. And so I'm going to try to hit a few key points. First of all, when he talks about the difference, you know, the definition of what priesthood is as a public function, as opposed to the Mormon notion of priesthood. This is a classic tension between traditional Christianity, and particularly sacramental Christianity, and which arises out of Judaism. I mean, the notion of the priest as this person who performs a ritual for the community, which you find in traditional and sacramental Christianity and Catholicism, really comes out of Judaism, the notion of the priest who performs the rites for the body. And that is different from the Mormon notion of priesthood and lay priesthood. That's the first thing you learn when you leave Mormonism and immerse yourself in sacramental Christianity and orders. It was the first thing I encountered, and which fascinated me. I was really grateful to be able to have the opportunity to immerse myself in priesthood formation and sacramental Christianity and that notion, and develop that side of priesthood for myself. So he's highlighted a really important tension there, and also the other really important tension that he has highlighted is the difference between the office, the title, and the function or role. And this is particularly crucial relating to women and Mormonism, because, and I agree with him, there is an enormous difference between the two. And what's interesting about Mormonism is that quite often men are granted the title and the office and the role function, whereas women are granted the role and the function, but not the title and the office. So the men have both, and women have the one. Back in 1996, I presented a paper at the Counterpoint Conference, which went back and looked at all the precedent in Mormon history for Mormon women to have functioned in a priesthood role, with or without the title. And in some cases, they had the title, and in some cases, they didn't. And I found precedent for women functioning in every single role or duty, from deacon to prophet. So it's there. And that's one point of tension, perhaps, between my position and Josh's, because and I can't oversimplify his paper. It's brilliant, and it's complex, and I can only respond in short, brief strokes here with the time we've got. But anyway, it's there. Mormon women have functioned in the roles and the duties without the title. So there's precedent in Mormonism for women to hold all the roles but not the titles. Although in some cases, as I said, they did hold titles. Another thing I wanted to mention, again, about this difference, say, in priesthood that he's characterizing between the public official role and a more lay or charismatic or diffuse or undefined priesthood, is what's interesting is that in Christian church history itself, you have that tension. In early Christianity, you have a more lay or charismatic priesthood. And then later, as Christianity develops, it's a much more official, formal role of the priest performing the duty for others, for a larger number of people. Whereas in early Christianity, you've got these notions of the house church, the bishop and the deacon as the host of the house and the servants, and you've got presbyters and missionaries and prophets and pastors and ministers, and it's a much more fluid, democratic, available to more numbers of people role in early Christianity. So that tension exists there too. In talking about Quinn, he's absolutely right that Quinn distinguishes between the role or function and the title or office. And Quinn focuses on the notion of Melchizedek priesthood as the priesthood and everything else being appendages. I was really glad that he cited that punchline. That was Mike and I's favorite line from the essay, that a woman doesn't need an appendage to have the priesthood. We laughed about that for a good 20 minutes when he read it to me on the phone. I'll never forget that day. He said, "Wait, you've got to hear this paragraph and wait for the punchline." and that was the punchline. He didn't really toy with the notion that women is endowed. He had the good sense to leave that one alone. But I think, in some ways, Mike, when he was talking about Melchizedek priesthood, he's talking about a third category. You could almost say he's talking about a third category. Besides title, office, and role, function, he's talking about the notion of order, an order of priesthood. And it's almost a third category, although in a way it can also be conflated with title or office. But this becomes a huge circular, this notion of title, office, order, and then back to title, office is kind of a circular progression. I would say another quote, or another point that Josh makes is that Quinn's premise is theological and not historical. It's a good point. It's a very good point, because he is making a theological argument. But I would say what he's doing is both historical and theological. I would say that the orders in Mormonism, and what's interesting is the orders of priesthood in Mormonism are, of course, somewhat different from the orders in traditional Christianity and Judaism, and yet they overlap. I would say the orders have stayed the same, patriarchal, Melchizedek, Aaronic, but it's the offices and duties and roles and titles that have changed and evolved. Although I'll come back to that point in a minute, because when you look at Mormon origins, you have this tension between charismatic priesthood power and the development of offices. A lot of people have talked about this, a lot of scholars, which is another interesting tension. But I would tend to respond to some of his arguments with, of course, the idea that it was not the women's priesthood that changed, it was their right to exercise it. So it was church policy that changed, and their possession of priesthood did not change. So it had to do with policy and permission that changed over time. A women's priesthood, and this is actually a tension between Mike and myself, because in Mike's essay, he says that one of the reasons he focuses on the order of Melchizedek priesthood as the source of priesthood and the offices as just appendages is that he's sort of seeing the institution of offices for women is requiring a new revelation, which I don't at all. I don't think any new revelation is required, because women received priesthood in several forms during the first 20 years of Mormonism, between 1830 and 1850. And again, Josh and I agree completely on those forms. Mormon women received priesthood through the authority and right to exercise spiritual charismatic power in blessings and healings. That was one form in the 1830s. Then in 1842, the Relief Society is another form of priesthood. And I completely, Josh again has just, I think, really keyed in on a crucial point, because I address these issues in the introduction in Women in Authority, and I mention that there are these different ways that women receive priesthood. So Relief Society is a second major way. Then the Temple Endowment in 1843 is a third major way or form. And then the Missionary Call, which is one I would add to Josh's paper, in 1850 when Louisa Barnes Pratt she's officially called and ordained to serve as a missionary, which is a form of priesthood, the Missionary Call. So women have these different forms, and those forms all continue. Those forms of priesthood were never revoked. And Joseph Smith intended for women to have priesthood and to exercise it, as he clearly indicates in the 1842 minutes of the Relief Society, when he makes all of his statements about recognizing their power and their position, and that Emma has been ordained, and that she should choose her own counselors, and that he wants the Relief Society to move according to the ancient order of the priesthood and function the same way that the male quorums do, and that the women should choose leaders and among themselves and function as deacons and apostles do among us, our order. So I think priesthood was clearly conveyed. It's just the degree of permission that women have to exercise those four forms which they still do as missionaries, and they still do in the Relief Society, and they still do in the temple. The one form that really has been revoked is the charismatic exercise of God's power through blessings and revelations and healings. Let's see. I know I don't have much time. There were just one other point, I guess, I wanted to make, and I'm trying to find it. This is such a rich and complex and challenging paper that it's sort of... it was about sister missionaries. I love the fact that you keyed in on the Doctrine and Covenants and the way that it defines priesthood. I looked at this in depth and detail and examined this in my essay on sister missionaries in Women in Authority and in the book, and the nature of their authority. I analyzed the call of the sister missionaries and as having several parts to it. But the point I keyed on was that in the Doctrine and Covenants, the definition of priesthood is inseparably connected to the preaching of the gospel. I completely agree with Josh. He's nailed it. And I said the same thing in my essay. But what's fascinating is what that does for women, because it's also inseparably connected with the office of elder. You didn't use some of those other quotes. I looked at every single one, you know, every single place where it's mentioned in the Doctrine and Covenants, just about, it's tied to the notion of elder. So that if sister missionaries can be called as missionaries, if they can be called to preach the gospel, according to the Doctrine and Covenants, that means they have priesthood and that means they have the office of an elder. Anyway, I'm going to have to stop there. I had a lot more to say, but I really appreciate Josh's work and all of you coming today. I have one final statement, okay? If I can find it, just that maybe there's no coherent definition. I agree. But that's one of the strengths of Mormonism also. It's a weakness and a strength, because Mormonism is highly syncretic in its theology. It's dynamic. It's evolving. It has a range of positions in its theology, in its doctrine, in its practice of priesthood. And I think this reflects the evolving nature of the Mormon psyche. So I agree with Josh, but I think it's not a totally bad thing. Thanks.
I feel bad having to cut off both of them, because they both have so many interesting things to say and insightful things. We only have about 5 minutes for questions, so please come up to the mic.
Great. Josh, thanks very much. Excellent presentation. Just as I'm thinking through this, I'm wondering if one of the ways that this can be understood well is through motivational tensions, where on the one hand, you consistently have Joseph Smith wanting to present a radical egalitarianism, and at the same time, wanting to preserve vertical hierarchies. And I think that another example would be with Revelation, his radicalization of the apostolic witness, his radical egalitarianism of deification. With the specific case of the egalitarianism of Revelation, you have in Doctrine and Covenants section 28, Hiram Page, in this case study from history, where Hiram Page is receiving revelations and having seer stones and doing all these things, actually doing the things that Joseph Smith said that any of the saints can do. And yet when it came around to it, Joseph Smith said, well, my revelations are better than your revelations. So it was basically, you know, putting him into his place in spite of this desire that Joseph did have to throw open the doors and totally liberalize the religious experience for all the saints. And I'm wondering if with what happened specifically in the Oath and Covenant of the Priesthood in DNC 84, if it was a similar situation where you had this flinging open of the doors where priesthood is something that all participate in. And yet, I'm wondering if any of you know something in the historical context that would make sense, that because suddenly you have him saying, okay, well, and he uses this as a qualifier, this priesthood that came from Melchizedek through Abraham, this priesthood, which is the keys of the mysteries, this, you know, and specifies why this priesthood is better, presumably, than the other priesthoods. I'm wondering, if you would agree with that context of these tensions of motivations, and then also if either you know about the historical context specifically for the Oath and Covenant of the Priesthood in that light.
Yeah, so, I mean, the way I think about this, as I said, I just think the priesthood throughout the DNC is just the function, or the office of performing a religious function, whatever it happens to be. What I left out of my paper is the idea that religious functions in Mormonism from a very early time, from 1830, were wrapped up in a church system of government. DNC Section 20 contains a lot of explicit ideas about what the offices in the church are supposed to be and what functions people with, you know, particular offices are supposed to form in a hierarchical structure. And so while there's nothing semantic about the word priesthood that, you know, connotes an idea of one position being greater or better than another, the hierarchical structure of the church that someone can have the office of performing a function in reference to does bring that idea along. And so, as far as I can tell, from a very, very early date, even though the word priesthood doesn't mean this, people start to think of priesthood in terms of a hierarchical structure. And so, for instance, when in DNC Section 21, we're told that, you know, no power or authority can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, it only makes sense to utter something like that if people in the church are starting to think about priesthood in terms of hierarchical power and authority. And so, I just think you have these two different ideas. You have a perfectly gender-neutral, sort of egalitarian notion of priesthood that's being coupled with a non-egalitarian hierarchical structure of the church. And throughout the 1830s and 40s, the membership is trying to make sense of that.
Well, yeah, well said, Josh. And I think that that tension, great question, that tension is crucial and is central and it's original. I think it needs to be there. That's the tension in Christianity. That's the tension in religious community. Anytime you have a religious community, it's there from the beginnings, in the very nature of Joseph's first visions, the establishing visions of the church. Because he has a Pauline charismatic experience of seeing God and not being ordained by the presiding authority of his time, and claiming, as the Apostle Paul did, I'm an apostle too, even though I never knew Jesus and I wasn't ordained. I received the spiritual call from God. So there's that incredible charismatic Pauline experience of seeing God, and yet Joseph at the same time, what does he have not long after that are visions of Peter, James, and John, and John the Baptist, who then confer the authority onto him. So he's got the Pauline experience, and he's still depending on the pillars of Jerusalem to convey their authority, which the Apostle Paul didn't. And I think the Doctrine and Covenants is important because it's a document that reflects his evolving understanding of authority. But to locate all authority and all definitions of priesthood with the document of the DNC, I think, is a limitation and a mistake and a place where I might have a tension with Josh, because the location of the definition and origins of priesthood and are located in the visions as well and in the evolution of it and not just in the DNC.
Thank you. This is just an outstanding presentation, and it explains to me, after more than 50 years in the church, and I never really had an understanding of what priesthood was, this is why I'm so confused. That said, I think it was explained to me with a session at Sunstone several years ago, with three women from the Community of Christ explaining what priesthood meant to them. Just sort of, you know, a few things that I disagree with in your logic and your process, but I'd like to see you revise your idea of proper noun using the word of the law, because that was one proper name noun that I thought is always got a the in front of it.
I'm dying to hear the comment that I could see in Paul Toscano's brain. Would you like to share a comment? I saw you get up and then sit down and then get up and then... This session wouldn't be complete without something for
well,
you.
Well, I just wanted to say that I find Mike, in defense of Mike, he addressed a couple of things which your paper doesn't, and I just wanted to say quickly what they are. One is the priesthood restored by Peter, James, and John was considered provisional. Because in October, I think, of 1839, Joseph Smith says the priesthood hasn't yet been restored, referring to the priesthood of Elijah. And then when the endowment is given, the investiture in the robes of the priesthood was another way of ordination, which was to the fullness or permanent priesthood. The priesthood earlier than that was considered by him, I believe, from the text, to be a scaffolding to build the temple where the true priesthood was going. So you have this idea of a provisional priesthood, which you haven't really addressed, versus this fullness of the priesthood. The other thing is the priesthood has an interior. It doesn't have just the... I completely disagree with you using the OED and tying everything back to that first statement, because that's only the social functions of the priesthood. The other priesthood function is the vertical function that ties the relationship between the individual to God,
making them a member of the holy order of God because they have true love. So you have a very, you have also the internal and outer manifestations of the priesthood, which your paper ignores. And then I think the point that was made before me about the use of the definite article, I mean, you can say love with the in front of it, like the love of his life or the courage of his convictions. So a lot of the times, the use of the definite and indefinite article turned upon the context of the sentence, which you didn't fully explain. So I see that there's a weakness there. But certainly, you're thinking about all of this, and the raising of these questions, I think, is very important. And I thank you for your paper.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm sorry we need to end this so we can get the next group in here. But let's give them all a round of applause.